Hello, and thank you for joining us today for our discussion about ambush marketing. I would like, if I may, to introduce briefly today's speakers, all of whom have slightly different backgrounds and therefore come at this topic from slightly different perspectives. Firstly, I'd like to introduce Cameron Mullane-Brown, who is a trademark attorney and will be today talking about some of the sort of portfolio management issues associated with developing a registered intellectual property strategy most effectively to perhaps protect yourself against an ambush marketing campaign. I'm also joined by David Holt, who's an intellectual property solicitor and commercial lawyer, who will be talking about some of the contractual issues associated with ambush marketing and again, how to best protect your brand against unwanted attention in this respect. And I'm Richard Roberts. I'm an intellectual property litigator. I'll be talking about some of the enforcement issues around ambush marketing and what the consequences can sometimes be for falling foul of the legal and regulatory issues in this area. Ambush marketing. What is it? Well, sometimes called parasitic or guerrilla marketing. It's both an important and controversial topic, and it can be, as we'll see a little later in this session, of great commercial and arguably even sociological significance. So in today's webinar, we'll start by discussing and describing what ambush marketing is, have a look at why it matters, what is its relevance, commercial impact. We'll then place it in its legal context, both in terms of common law and from a regulatory perspective, particularly focusing on the UK. We'll then look at the tools which are available to event managers, official sponsors, both legal and practical, to enable people to safeguard themselves against these sort of potentially damaging practices. When placed in context, I will pass on to Mr. Holt, who will talk about some real-life examples of ambush marketing. Cameron will indicate how to create that effective IP portfolio that I mentioned earlier, and then David will talk about those contractual safeguards and practical issues. If we have time at the end, we'll then return to some of the bigger questions, the limits on ambush marketing rules, and also maybe some ethical questions about actually whether ambush marketing is indeed the terrible thing that it is often professed to be. Well, any talk about ambush marketing really has to begin with a working definition. This isn't always straightforward because this is not a creature of statute. For today's purpose, we're going to work with the idea that ambush marketing is essentially any attempt by a third party to associate itself directly or indirectly with a major brand or event in order to benefit from its reputation, goodwill, or prestige, without having to pay for that privilege, as for example, an official sponsor would have to do. Now, as I said, this is not set in stone, and actually the lines around what does and does not constitute ambush marketing are to a degree a little bit blurred. And this is a topic that Dave is going to discuss in a little bit of detail in his session, perhaps some more unusual examples of marketing practices that could potentially fall into this category. Once we've dealt with the what, and then we'll move on to the why. So, why is ambush marketing such a big issue? Well, major events, particularly big sporting events, are big business at the end of the day, and there's an example set out on this slide. At the end of the day, organisers of major events make huge amounts of revenue from and depend enormously on investment by their sponsors. So in London 2012 Olympics, in the region of £750 million of the International Olympic Committee's revenue derived from sponsors and marketing activities. So with such vast amounts of money involved, official sponsors ultimately do expect a degree of exclusivity for their investment. And without the guarantee of that exclusivity, the concern is that critical revenue streams will ultimately dry up and the events will just not take place. So having set out the what and the why, what about the how? What is the relevant legislative and legal framework for purpose of assessing the lawfulness or otherwise of ambush marketing? Well, this is, again, not straightforward because there is no single law directed to this issue. Rather, what we have is a kind of a hodgepodge, a mosaic of various different common law and statutory rights which potentially impact on ambush marketing practices. And I've set out some of the key ones on this next slide. Registered trademark protection. Well, often a major sporting event or the devices associated with it are the subject of registered trademark protection, giving the trademark proprietor a degree of control over the manner in which that brand is then used. Rights in passing off. So from a UK perspective, a kind of common law trademark, unregistered trademark right. Copyrights. Well, again, particularly relevant in respect of, for example, logos and device marks, often constitute artistic works, which the copyright holder is then entitled to restrain the reproduction of within given context by third parties. Design rights, similar to copyright in that respect, and domain names. Then, in addition to the sort of standard intellectual property rights that potentially subsist in this area, there's also a plethora of legislation, for example, the business and consumer protection regulations and the advertising standards or CAP codes. So in addition to those sort of general frameworks within which marketeers are typically operating, there are also tailored rules and regulations specifically intended to address ambush marketing as an issue. These are typically event specific, and I've set out a couple of these on this slide. So clearly the first two of these relate to specifically the Olympic Games, 1995 and 2006 legislation. Trade Description Act, also touched on, while largely repealed, does also contain some provisions relevant to, for example, the use of the monarch's brand, as it were, and when that is and is not permissible, which I suppose could also be regarded as a species of ambush marketing. So, having outlined the framework within which these practices take place, what can people do to tackle them, and both in advance and then in the context of a campaign as and when it takes place? Well, there's a top-level summary of some of these issues set out on this slide. Cameron and David will address each of these in greater depth, so I'm just going to touch on these very lightly at this particular point. But as indicated previously, we've got contractual safeguards. So agreements that might take place actually between organisations, for example, an event organiser and a sponsor, regulating the manner in which a brand is to be used and the steps, for example, that the event organiser must take to prevent other people using their brand in an impermitted way. Ticketing terms. So, for example, people who buy tickets may be regulated in terms of whether they can be given away as part of a prize competition. Intellectual property protection. Well, we've touched on this a moment ago, but actually securing registered intellectual property protection, for example, trademarks or design rights, can be quite a powerful tool in terms of restraining the way in which third parties can then use those brands in an unauthorized way. In addition to the legal restrictions, there's also practical steps that can be undertaken. For example, actually controlling the physical environment in which an event takes place. What happens when people fall foul of these, for example, registered intellectual property rights or protections? Well, ultimately, civil proceedings, for example, can be brought to obtain an injunction to restrain unauthorised activity, or indeed to obtain damages as a remedy. And finally, there is also, of course, regulatory enforcement. So we've touched on the advertising regulations and CAP codes and so on. So bodies such as the ASA and trading standards may also get involved to ensure that those regulations are adhered to. I'll pass on at that point to David, who's going to talk us through some real-life examples of ambush marketing to really bring this topic to life.
Great. Thanks, Richard. As mentioned, for those listening and not watching, David Holt, I'm a solicitor in the litigation and licensing team at Potter Clarkson. So I'm going to go through some historic examples to start with of ambush marketing to try and create a framework by which we understand the activities both now and sort of in the modern era. The first one I'll mention is probably one of the most notorious examples, which is in 1984. Kodak sponsored the broadcasts, the US broadcast of the Olympics. And what most people in the US didn't know was that Fuji was in fact the official sponsor. Anecdotally, they managed to step into Fuji's place as the main camera brand associated with the event, which given the history between Fuji and Kodak, I think was a bit of a coup. This feeds quite nicely into something I'll touch on later, which is understanding the scope of exclusivity and the rights you're going to get in your sponsorship agreements. So we'll circle back on that a bit later. But it's now one of the most famous examples of Kodak actually stepping in and ambushing Fuji on their major sponsorship deal. Some more recent but still quite historic examples, even though it doesn't feel like it. 2012 Olympics, Paddy Power was one of my favourite brands for their own marketing. On this event, they promoted themselves on a billboard as having sponsored the largest sporting event in London, France, which I understand was a horse race, which is pretty common for Paddy Power. But they weren't the only ones to work on this territorial wordplay during that period. Nike were also involved in a Find Your Greatness campaign where they took various Londoners from London, England, and took them to compete in various Londons around the world, including London, Ohio. Definitely trading on the power of association here, and we always think whether somebody's on the right side of the line or the wrong side of the line in terms of ambush marketing, you'll always find big brands sailing close to the wind. And one of the other examples I find interesting, because it brings the individual into ambush marketing, not just the companies involved, the use of accessories and props. So you've got Michael Johnson in 1996 with Nike. He had his custom gold running shoes that he slung around his neck to make sure they were front and center of any TV broadcast, with Adidas being the main sponsor. I can't imagine that went down particularly well. And Linford Christie allegedly sacrificed his sporting performance for his sponsorship wearing Puma contact lenses, which according to him were pretty uncomfortable. Luckily he only had to run in a straight line as far as I understand it, but it can't have been particularly great for him. Since then, Usain Bolt with Puma have picked up on the shoes around the shoulders angle. Manu Tuilagi in 2011, for those of more rugby fans, was fined for wearing a branded gum shield because he was the centre of the attention that year, and he was fined personally as a result of that breach. Whether he claimed that back from his sponsor, I don't know, but it brings the individual into the firing line as well as the brands. So it's not necessarily just something that goes out on a national basis or is entirely brand-led. And I think this is one of your favourites, Cameron, actually. The 2012 Olympics, again, Beats providing free headphones to, as I believe, every athlete in the Olympic Village. Massively changed the focus of individuals. Lots of multicoloured headphones appearing all over the place. I think Swimming Pool was pretty famous. I mean, in terms of the expenditure, it was probably less than you paid for official sponsorship, but it seemed to work. And moving on to the more modern approach, I think the advent of social media has really changed how brands are choosing to market in increasingly innovative and interesting ways. Whether or not these examples are going to fall foul of the legal definition of ambush marketing, or even some of the ways we tried to capture it with Richard's definition, sort of unclear, but they're definitely worth discussing because we're seeing these new approaches on the marketing side more and more at the moment. And we do have to think about what's acceptable, what's not, what can be protected and what can't. Some of it's around news rather than specific sponsored events. The first example is a bit of a mix between the two, with Pringles stepping in and offering free footballs and football equipment following the cancellation of the 2020 Euros. Now, I think they were very careful not to use the actual the name of the tournament, but everyone knew when they were talking about missing the football this summer exactly what they were referring to. So they flirted just outside the line and made sure they garnered as much attention as possible without actually stepping in and saying, if you're missing the European Championships, then please buy our crisps.
Following that, I've seen examples from, you know, Burger King and McDonald's, interestingly, following the lockdown announcements and the closure of restaurants or opening restaurants on a limited basis. Burger King and McDonald's took the example of actually recommending each other on their Twitter feeds and suggesting that customers should go out and support others because everyone's been suffering during the lockdown. And again, it's quite a heartwarming practice in a way, although they are obviously making some good PR gains as a result. And you've got other companies like Wendy's who seem to spend most of their time on social media just insulting people for attention. But it does allow marketers to reach people in new and innovative ways. Another example was Snickers and Nando's, who both took the very well publicised Luis Suarez red card and suggested that perhaps he might like to try their brand of food rather than trying to take a bite out of an opponent. I don't think the World Cup organisers could have any argument with the fact that they chose to pick up on it as a newsworthy event, but again, it just shows the responsive nature of these type of marketing channels and how quickly you can pick up on it. And then finally, individuals taking photographs at events, you know, major players on the Instagram scene, Messi, who has a huge number of followers, people like Cheslin Kolbe, Neymar Jr., taking advantage of being involved in these major events, putting things up on their personal Instagram with photographs they've taken themselves and using that as a platform for increasing their own popularity. And again, that isn't necessarily something the organisers had foreseen, but it's definitely a way that those individuals are making the most of the marketing opportunities. And then finally, I think it's a really popular subject at the moment, but NFTs and capturing moments is something that a lot of sporting brands are talking about. And it'd be interesting to see going forward, given the open nature of NFTs, the fact that you can mint one yourself, whether there will be people taking screen grabs of broadcasts of major sporting events and using the opportunity to sell these and maybe marketing their own brand alongside. And that brings up some copyright issues and also some issues of anonymity, because you won't necessarily know who it was that's minted these NFTs, because it could be associated with a wallet that's not held by the individual that's done it in the first place. So it really does bring about some enforcement troubles that may concern people going forwards. And I think I wanted to go in a bit more detail on a couple of examples I've looked at over the last year or so. I think they're very popular ones, so you'll forgive me if I don't rehearse all of the facts behind it, but the BrewDog case of the solid gold can, I think everyone's quite familiar with the fact that the can was mostly brass, I think is probably a fair way of characterising it, with some 24-carat plating. The ASA upheld the 15 complaints about the wording of the advertising themselves, but it's what BrewDog did next, I think, that's the most interesting, in that they took the decision and used it as a springboard for a new marketing campaign and a new competition, which was categorised as a solid gold apology. Now, the ASA has obviously got an interesting status in that it's there to enforce rules, as Richard said, around the cap code, but also is trying to protect consumers. And with a brand able to use that decision, which is supposed to be commercially negative for them, as a springboard to actually increasing their reach into the consumer market is an interesting one from an ethical point of view. I think if you had a publicised judgment from a court, if you chose to treat it in that manner, you may be running the risk of bringing up the ire of the court in doing so. But you can't argue with the results, and it does seem to have made them incredibly popular in certain circles. And then the second one is Cuthbert Gate, as I like to call it. I think, again, there's a lot of people writing on this and there's a lot of really interesting content. But I think the lessons from this particular example do tell us a lot about how you can deal with ambush marketing, particularly when it appears and disappears so quickly as it does on social media. In a wonderful move, I think, and I have to, from a marketing point of view at least, support exactly what Aldi have been doing, is that they managed to deflect the potential legal action and really garner a huge amount of positive PR from their response to M&S's initial statements or initial approaches in relation to their own caterpillar cake. You know, bringing in references to charities and offering a solution outside of any formal legal proceedings is a very clever way of making sure that you're not harmed too much by potentially negative publicity. And I think M&S really have shown that one of the key learnings is don't overreact, because if you actually engage with this, if you start debating back, with a marketing team that's really trying to engage you, you're allowing them to take over your marketing channels as well as their own, which is a huge victory for them because they may be reaching a market that they've never actually seen before. That also reminds me of a particular example of a historic Olympic Games where they tried to sneak a lot of orange lederhosen in on a number of crowd members. The response from security was to remove the orange lederhosen, which meant that you actually had a lot of people in the stadium who weren't wearing any trousers, which, strangely enough, was more noticeable perhaps than the lederhosen in the first place. So if you do react, you've got potentially unintended consequences coming out of the back of it. So it is... Yeah, it's something you really need to think about carefully before you respond to. The right response might not be legal action or taking things down a formal channel straight away. And then the latest update, I think, which probably says too much about my Instagram feed as to where it's come from. There's an example of Cuthbert being dragged away by a couple of sour lemons in the back of the Aldi advert this Christmas. And so it looks like they're not going to let this one go for a while. So it'd be interesting to see how M&S respond. So those were my examples recently, and I'm just going to pass on to Cameron now, who will teach you about how to formulate an effective brand registration strategy.
Thank you very much, Dave. Yes, as Richard said, my name is Cameron. I am a trademark attorney with Potter Clarkson, and I've been drafted in to speak about registering your brand, trying to avoid the pitfalls that the ambush marketers are going to try and target. I should say this section is going to focus on the ambush marketee, as it were, so the party trying to avoid the ambush marketer, rather than how you might look to attack as an ambush marketer. We may well come on later to discussing how the ambush marketer might approach these things, but for the sake of this discussion, it will be focused on the brand holder. So to begin, just to cover off some of the categories of rights, Richard has already commented on a few of the different registered rights that are available, and I suspect that for the purpose of this presentation, it will largely centre on trademarks, but in the name of completeness, I should also mention there are design rights that are available, so protecting the... sorry, I should move this slide on for those who are watching. Protecting the shape or configuration of the whole or part of an article to the extent that it's novel. There are various exclusions. I won't go into too much detail on any of these rights, but just to say that they do exist and they're worth considering. Trademarks, as I said, so a right over the origin function of your sign, the means with which the consumer identifies who it is they're purchasing from so that they can repeat that purchase, hopefully, or avoid that purchase if need be. There's also copyright to consider. Now, those of you, the eagle-eyed of you, and on this panel, no doubt, who are thinking copyright is not registrable in the UK, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. You are half correct. The first part of that is absolutely correct, that copyright is not registrable in the UK. It is registrable in other jurisdictions, but it's worth mentioning. So copyright is a right that arises upon expression of a creative work to the extent that it is the intellectual creation of the artist. I have included a miscellaneous category here. As Richard mentioned, there are other categories of registration that are worth bearing in mind. So things like domain names, increasing importance every day, it seems, social media handles, which now constitute extremely valuable real estate. Places like customs, where you can register your brand. There are other places you can register your interests, but these categories are going to be the most relevant for the sake of this discussion. So having touched on what a registration may look like, it's worth also covering why you might look to register your brand. And there are a great many reasons as to why we would look to register a brand in the event that you are going to be engaging with an event which is likely to be targeted by the ambush marketers. So typically these events, as Dave said, are going to be large, often international events, which are going to give rise to a huge amount of publicity such that the licensing arrangement is so lucrative and valuable. So the first benefit to touch on, as it's often overlooked, is that there may well simply be a requirement for your being involved in the event that you are simply required to register your brand in order to comply with the various stipulations of the event organiser. So registering your IP interests may actually be out of your hands if you wish to be part of these kinds of events. Over and above that, the scope of enforcement of your brand, of your rights in your brand, are simply stronger if you have a registered right to rely on. Obviously, this applies in the courts, but also in other venues. So, for example, there are plenty of third-party platforms you may wish to enforce through. You may need to utilise trading standards or customs. And these sorts of entities are far better at enforcing your rights if they have a clearly defined registration with which to enforce. There are also various licensing opportunities that may require you to register your IP. I appreciate David's going to touch shortly on the contractual side of things. I have mentioned again here on this slide, for those of you who can see, that there are avenues for copyright registration. I may have included that twice, simply to show that I do understand that copyright is not registrable in the UK. Yes. Just in case anyone was unsure. It is registrable overseas. And to the extent it is registrable copyright, it is worth bearing in mind. China and the US come to mind as venues where you can register copyright. If there is means to register copyright, it often indicates that it is very important to do so, which is something that is missed, I think, by a lot of UK-based parties who are used to copyright arising without any need for registration.
It can have an impact on damages as well, is worth noting, particularly in the US. The damages angle is always worth thinking about. Getting it registered so you've got notice is useful.
Yeah, sure. And there's also the use of the R symbol and the TM symbol. As practitioners in the brand world, it's a question we receive almost on a weekly basis when parties are permitted to use the R symbol and the TM symbol. So naturally, having a registered right means that you are permitted to use that R symbol. Otherwise, you will just have to indicate by way of the TM symbol that you're using a trademark. And then finally on this slide, there's a point around deterrence. So ambush marketers increasingly are extremely savvy, and the extent of the checks and the reviews and the analysis that they're performing before they're proceeding is pretty considerable. And as a result, having a registered right, having a clear indicator to third parties that you have protected your interests in your sign, is often a good deterrent to this kind of behaviour. So unless there are any other big reasons that my colleagues want to raise? No? Okay. So now looking at what elements of your brand may well be suitable for registration. There are what I've called here the traditional elements of branding, traditional from a usage point of view. That's things like colours and words, slogans, logos, these sorts of things. But there is also an additional few categories of elements which are not traditionally viewed as obvious indicators of brand. So things like patterns and shapes, sounds, tastes, the list goes on. I've sought to give some examples here, and I've used McDonald's as my go-to brand, partially because I miss lunch, and I'm hoping I can incept into my colleagues an idea as to what we should do after this is concluded. But secondly, because McDonald's have really run the gambit in terms of what brand elements can be used to indicate to the consumer who they're interacting with. So for those of you who can see on the slide, we've the colours, the red and yellow. We've the word McDonald's, of course. There's also obviously the stylized word McDonald's, which didn't make it to my slide. The stylized golden arches, the M logo. There's also the slogan, I'm loving it, and the jingle, which accompanies it. Dave, do you care to whistle the jingle for us?
I'll pass on.
No? Okay. So deaf. I think as soon as I said I'm loving it, we all heard the sound in our head. So strong is that branding. And then finally, there's the pattern at the bottom of the slide, for those of you who can see it, which I'm reliably informed appears on the fillet of fish, which is not something I myself have ordered recently. So there's a huge range of indicators in the brand holder's arsenal that can be used to indicate to the consumer who they are. Just a final point on this slide. It's worth bearing in mind that the scope of your registration is going to be influenced by the goal of avoiding the ambush marketers. So there are any number of motivations for registering any variety of the brand elements that we've identified. If you are looking to avoid a party who are searching around your protected rights for a chink, for a means of getting in there and trying to not necessarily imitate, but allude to the brand wherever there is a weakness, you want to ensure your rights are as broad as possible so that the scope of use that you can challenge is equally broad. So, for example, perhaps you might consider not registering a stylized wordmark with additional elements of varying distinctive character. You might look to just register the wordmark in capital letters for as broad a scope as you can. And a similar thought process applies to the coverage of your trademarks as well. You may look to deviate slightly beyond your standard scope of use with the purpose of preventing any ambush marketer from attacking that weakness. So just to move on to a few considerations, having covered what a registration might be and what it might cover. The first point I wanted to touch on is confidentiality. So trademark applications are very much on the public record. There's no means of hiding the applicant details, at least not for very long, which means that when you're filing your application for trademark protection, you need to bear in mind that third parties will see what you're doing. And there is a huge number of hawk-eyed journalists who monitor trademark registers, particularly for large Silicon Valley type brands who are constantly revolutionizing the way we do things. There are plenty of journalists who are just waiting for an application that they can then try and guess what they're going to be seeing. So use of a straw man holding company might well be advisable. So filing in the name of a different entity to your house brand or your main holding company in order that third parties can't identify precisely what it is you're doing. The second point is around timings. So registration is it can be relatively quick in the sense that it can be done in the UK at least in around 6 to 8 months. It's not instantaneous, which means if you are planning on engaging with the kind of event that the ambushers may target, you need to be building this into your lead time. It's no good having a pending right or a pending application if you're trying to sue someone and you've another 3 months till the thing's going to be registered. You may find yourself in a situation where the damage is so immediate and so apparent that damages in several months, even seeking retrospective damages, are not going to cover the loss you've suffered, especially assuming that the event that's being ambush marketed is sufficiently public and far-reaching that really was the value of your being involved in the first place. You may wish to look at things like design registrations and potentially even copyright as something which arises quicker as a means of enforcement. The next point I wanted to cover is ownership. So in the UK, at least, there are plenty of different potential owners who cannot hold property. So the obvious example is an unincorporated association. So I'm going to get raised by one of my solicitor friends, I'm sure, very quickly. But groups of people, so bands, for example, musical acts, commonly fall short on trying to seek ownership of something where they are not a unit, which is recognised as a legal entity in the UK. So think about who's going to hold the property, where it needs to be. And of course, if you are registering your right with a view to licensing it, you need to think about who's going to own it, where the goodwill in the use is going to vest, and various other points. So it's worth really paying close attention to who's going to own the right. As a trademark attorney, I almost certainly ought to have started the slide with clearance work, and I'm confident I will be chastised when I get back to the office of not having done so, as clearance is so important, and it is something we spend so much time emphasising to our clients. If you are going into an event which is, as I've said, of a large enough scale that it could be ambush marketed, the last thing you need is to discover too late that your brand is simply not enforceable, or there's a third party with an earlier right, or there's any number of these issues, which could not only cause you your own infringement concerns, but could massively prevent you from enforcing against third parties who seek to draw affiliation with yourself. So it's well worth, once again, building into your lead time to clear the brand and understand the landscape of risk before you proceed, in order to make sure you can capitalise on the full commercial value of the event you're trying to be associated with. So moving on to the next slide. I'm going to try and summarise as quickly as I can. And I have begun here with clearance as well, so I did learn my lesson from the previous slide. Checking for registrability and enforceability and the landscape of risk ahead of time is absolutely vital and well worth doing so. The cost of taking that step can be dwarfed extraordinarily quickly in the event that you are stymied later on. It's also worth really considering what elements of your brand may indicate origin. I think marketing agencies and marketing teams are extremely good at informing the consumer who it is they're commercially interacting with, and I think it often surprises people what may be registrable as a brand asset. Certainly there are plenty of tools in the brand holder's arsenal that are absolutely worthy of registration, while sparing in mind, as I mentioned, confidentiality. The breadth of protection, also something that needs to be considered. Starting your registration process with an idea of what it is you're trying to avoid, what it is you're potentially going to have to enforce against, is a fantastic way to start things. Selecting the correct right for registration for a similar reason is extremely important. So understanding what it is the consumers rely on to identify you, and thereby what it is the ambush marketers are going to be most interested in. And then finally, we talked about controlling the physical environment of the event to assist in hiding away from these ambush marketers. If you are allowing third parties to use your brand, if you're going to use the wide-scale event as a means of spreading your network, potentially by way of new affiliates or licensees or just third parties interacting, making sure there is a very clear set of brand guidelines to ensure your brands are presented to the public in a nice, uniform, consistent way. This is why
We spoke about McDonald's earlier. There is such a clear, strong, uniform brand image that you can tell from a mile away, or as soon as you can smell the restaurant, exactly who it is you're going to be dealing with. And that's it puts them in a really, really strong position to try and undermine these ambush marketers. So with that, I shall move back to Dave to cover some of the contractual obligations. And I'll even give you the slide.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Great. So I'm going to go through some hopefully practical points for contractual protection around ambush marketing. Just some aid memoirs really to think about when you're going to get into these types of arrangements and the value to them. So I was going to start off with licenses and contracts for exclusive events. Exclusivity, I think, is something that's bandied around quite a lot. But from a licensing point of view, where you've got registered IP to license, you can be incredibly creative as to how you break these licenses down. And that goes two ways. That can benefit the organizer of the event because it gives them many different ways to slice the particular pie. But also, if you're negotiating your own license, you really need to think about what's within the scope and what potentially falls outside it. And to an extent, you might need a creative mindset to think about what might fall outside rather than what falls within. I think the Fuji and Kodak example I talked about is a really good example of this, because Fuji may well have thought they'd got everything locked up, but they didn't necessarily think about the territorial impact of the broadcast rights. And Kodak were able to step in there and take a really big territorial win in one of their home markets to make sure that they actually got front and centre before the consumers. So I've put territorial as the principal one on this slide because it's probably the one that you're most familiar with. But there's also, particularly when we're talking about major sporting events, you've got sectoral opportunities for licenses. You have clothing, you have food, you have the ability to put something on a billboard outside a particular sport. If you're associated with it, you can put it on goggles. You can be the official headphone sponsor or unofficial headphone sponsor if you're just willing to give everyone some very nice headphones to take home with them. So all of these things are really important to think about. And again, as Cameron's mentioned before, have your goal in mind when you're looking to frame the license that you want. Think about the sectors that you most naturally align with and think about where you would want that exclusivity. And the final one is temporal. So obviously an event will only run for a certain period of time, but you need to make sure that your license covers you for the entire period throughout which you think it'll be valuable. So that may be during the 4 or 5 weeks of run-up to the event rather than just the weeks themselves. Or I like to think of Wimbledon as an example, classically English. If you were the first week sponsor versus the second week sponsor, think about the value of that. If you were sponsoring all of the qualifying and the early stages within the Wimbledon Village itself, you may find you have a slightly lower footfall than you would if you're in the finals week. So it's important to look at the value of the license you're getting, think about what you're getting out of it as well as what you're putting in. So it's always worth planning these things well in advance. And then secondly, I've suggested perhaps where no registered IP exists, which is probably going to be uncommon, particularly if you've got someone like Cameron looking after you, you need to think about the practical steps that go with this. So if you've got contractual terms on enforcement against third parties, perhaps where Richard mentioned you have kind of a clean area around a stadium or something similar, who's going to take responsibility for enforcing that particular area that you're relying on to create value in your contract? Do you have to do it? Do you have to hire your own security company? If you're only running one or two food trucks, say, in a particular area, it's not potentially going to be practical for you to do that. You may end up spending more than you actually generate in terms of exclusive revenue. So always plan these things in advance. The role of confidentiality, I think, as Cameron's mentioned, on the side of getting your marks registered is very important. But also, if you are disclosed as an official sponsor too early, it may give ambush marketers more time to plan. So think about when you're willing to allow the organizer to disclose you as the partner. Obviously, of course, this may be helpful to have it well in advance because it builds the PR advantage for you. You get more interest in your business in advance of the event, but that can come with a flip side as well. So think these things through before you sign on the license. In terms of recourse to the ASA, again, where there's no registered rights, if it's more to do with your brand, do you take responsibility for making a complaint? Or on the other side, if it's an equally balanced relationship between, say, you and the event, and then the marketer trying to compare itself to perhaps you in the context of the event. Should you be splitting the cost of this 50-50? Who's going to enforce? Who's best placed to enforce? Who has the most legitimate claim against the ambush marketer? And again, planning these things ahead means that you're not left in a position of having to scrabble around where you've only maybe got a week or 2 weeks to play with during the event to resolve the problem. You've almost lost if you have to spend that extra planning time working out who's going to resolve the issues that are in front of you. And then I've just highlighted some key contractual clauses because I'm mostly a licensing lawyer and I love contractual clauses. So I've laid these out. A number of you will be familiar with these, so apologies if I'm rehashing anything you already know. But the warranties are the contractual promises that are generally made at the time of signing by the parties. It's really important to get these right. You can copy and paste in warranties from a previous agreement, but because they are so specific to the circumstances you're looking at, you want to make sure that they accurately reflect exactly what you want to be receiving from the other party. So take a little bit of time, review these, make sure the promises are ones that you can tie down in terms of whether they've been satisfied or not, because that's equally important. But also make sure that you're not just putting in generic warranties for the sake of it. Make sure they give you the coverage you need. If there is a breach of these, it's normally a financial remedy, but there tends to be a fairly substantial burden of proof in terms of the quantity of damages that you're looking to receive back for those breaches. And then you've got indemnities, which are a bit like warranties on steroids. They potentially allow access to more substantial financial remedies and can reduce some of the burden of proof in respect of breach, so you can find it slightly more easy to enforce these. Penalty clauses as well are quite often forgotten. The Parking Eye case, for example, talked about the commercial justifications for these, but if you're working with a partner and you have a good concept of the sort of losses that you would suffer if they were to breach a particular term of the contract, you might want to put in a fixed penalty. And then you're not having an argument about what damage you've suffered. You've already made it clear, you've agreed between the two of you, and provided that it meets the basic test for having a real commercial goal for putting it in, you need to make sure it's reasonable, of course, but generally agreed between two businesses will be something you can enforce. So think about that as well as an addition to an indemnity. I've mentioned the enforcement clause, but in the context of, for example, registered rights, it's always worth getting these things agreed in advance. As I say, if you want to try and put together a litigation agreement before you end up suing somebody during the course of an event, even though we do work quickly, the licensing lawyers are going to take a while to pull together a full litigation agreement to allow you to take action against somebody who's infringing on your rights. So get the basics of these down in the agreement if you can. Get them agreed in advance. Work out who's going to be paying for it. Work out who's going to take action and go on that basis. And then worst case scenario, termination and break clauses. Are there any circumstances under which you want to get out from the license? Would you want some of the monies you paid to be refunded? You know, do you need the right to be able to exit this agreement if it starts, say, 6 months before the event does? Do you need to be able to pull out in certain circumstances? Of course, you're always hoping it's going to work perfectly. Everything's going to be blue skies and increased revenue. But if there are certain things, perhaps in your supply chain or elsewhere, that you might need to ensure you don't suffer too much risk as a result of, think about your ways of getting out as well. And then finally, negotiation tips. All of the things I've talked about, you can cover off in heads of terms. Think about your goals for the agreement. Think about where you want to get to by the end of your negotiation process. Sometimes just putting that down on paper will help you immensely in getting the agreement you want out of it. And also, you might actually uncover things that you wouldn't have otherwise thought about if you'd started off looking at a full license agreement precedent, maybe, and then trying to work backwards. If you work from a blank piece of paper, quite often you can pick up things you'd otherwise miss. So think about that for clarity of the agreement and the goals as well. And then finally, given the existence of ambush marketing, given the existence of social media and the numerous other ways now you can make sure you've got the attention of the public, think about whether the agreement's worth it. Make a value judgment on it and take into account all of the things that I've mentioned. Think about the cost-benefit side of things, because it may not be your only solution. Because marketing is obviously an incredibly creative industry, so although the official sponsorship is one route, perhaps try and be as creative as the marketing companies who are looking to ambush and think about whether that could work for you as well. And with that, I'm going to pass back to Richard.
David, thank you. So over the course of the last 50 minutes or so, we've talked about what ambush marketing is, Why it's of significance. These events are big business, commercially very valuable. We talked about how people can seek to address the issue of ambush marketing. But before we close today, I thought it would be helpful to really to ask the final question about the weather. The idea of whether ambush marketing is always a bad thing, I suppose. I think maybe it's fair to say just before we get onto these sort of ethical discussions is that although the suite of intellectual property protection which you may seek to create can be very strong, although the regulations which may exist in relation to a given event may be again very powerful, these rights are not absolute, and that the various different intellectual property rights or specific regulations do have defences and exceptions within them. So, for example, there are often descriptive or fair use exemptions. There's often exemptions for journalistic purposes or for people who perhaps write pre-existed the event in question. That's a complex topic, and it's something that one should always take detailed advice on before deciding whether or not to run a given marketing campaign. But I think it's probably worth just bearing that in mind. But that leads us on really to that final question about whether ambush marketing is inherently wrong. I suppose the difficulty lies in the title a little bit. Ambush marketing, parasitic marketing, guerrilla marketing. It's always sort of a slightly pejorative term where the question invites a given answer. But I suppose these things do depend a little bit on your individual point of view. The idea that one man's terrorist might be another man's freedom fighter could equally apply to the case of ambush marketing. Taking major sporting events as an example, for example, events like the Olympics can cost countries huge amounts of monies to put on and be extremely disruptive from a country's point of view. There is one school of thought that perhaps the rules relating to ambush marketing, principally there to protect the interests of the event organisers and the official sponsors, typically big business, can sometimes make it very difficult for small businesses or individuals within these countries to really benefit from the events themselves. And obviously that would raise difficult issues, just as the draconian, in some respects, nature of some of these rights and regulations inevitably have a degree of impact on free speech. So with that sort of preamble in mind, I would pose two questions to my learned panellists today. My first to David, really, picking up on a comment that he made in his talk about thinking very carefully before objecting to an ambush marketing campaign. I think what's probably fair to say is many of the examples that he gave earlier, it's kind of the ambush marketing company or individual that you sometimes remember the most, perhaps much more than the official sponsor. And sometimes that's principally by virtue of the song and dance that the official sponsor may have made in relation to the marketing campaign. So question for Dave really is, what advice would you give to event organisers or official sponsors before deciding whether or not to object to a campaign? And second question, one for Cameron really, because he's talked eloquently about the suite of intellectual property protection, the sort of barrier of registered trademarks that one can seek to create. Cameron, do you think that the law has gone too far here, and is ambush marketing inherently an evil practice? David.
Okay, so I mean, learned colleague, I think you're probably overselling it, but you can judge on the basis of my answer, I think.
If I may, he also smiled as he said learned colleague.
Yeah, I know, I felt that was a little bit
tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would I think about before choosing to respond? I think that's an incredibly complicated question, so I'll try and sum it up as quickly as I can. But I think a lot of it has to do with who you are as a brand. I think if you do not have a reputation for engaging in the type of back and forth on social media, if you don't have a reputation for reactive marketing at all, I think you're probably better off staying out of that arena. I think companies like Aldi have demonstrated where it can be incredibly successful. But I think if it's inconsistent with
your brand the way you market normally, it would be seen as quite an alien action for you. I think anything you do choose to do should be consistent with the impression you want to give to the public. And then in terms of the more formal actions, I think there are ways you can make anonymous complaints to the ASA, for example. You can have other people make complaints to the ASA on your behalf. So that might be a way you choose to go about it, to try and chastise somebody through that route. In terms of formal litigation, I think you also need to consider your size, the size of the other party. I think you can easily be seen as David and Goliath, and this is something I've spoken about before, actually, because Aldi managed to paint the picture of being a much smaller entity compared to big, bad M&S, when actually that's completely inconsistent. In fact, the global turnover for Aldi is actually substantially more than the global turnover of M&S. So you would definitely be talking about an equality of arms with us to go to litigation. But the public's perception of that was completely different. And also, finally, you wouldn't want to be going after an ambush marketer where you have no opportunity to actually get the recovery you're seeking. It's universally true that registered rights are very good for dissuading people, but you also need to make a sensible choice once you've got those registered rights as to who you enforce against. It's important to do it sometimes just to send a message, so you may choose to do it for that benefit. But if you're going after an impecunious marketer, if you're going after a very small company, you both run a PR risk and a financial risk, because you may not be able to recover any of the costs that you actually expend, and the company may well fold before you get a decision. So you've got to weigh all these things up together, I think.
Interesting, thank you. So think long and hard, and make sure that your response is consistent with your brand image, perhaps.
I think so.
Cameron, is it inherently wrong?
I wonder if you may be expecting a one-word answer. I'm not sure I can manage that. I'm not quite so pithy. I think before I answer, I'd like to caveat this heavily with the assumption that we agree that ambush marketing does not require, as part of its definition, any kind of consumer confusion. I think that for the sake of my answer, I'd like to move aside instances of ambush marketing that go too far, so to speak, and mislead consumers as to who they're engaging with. That obviously is a huge concern, and certainly a lot of the trademarks legislation in the UK is drafted with that specific mischief in mind, that specific goal in mind, to prevent consumers from being misled. So that would be my first caveat. My second caveat of 11, no, this is my second and final caveat, is that marketing departments walk an extremely tight line and are unbelievably good at navigating this landscape and avoiding obstacles and sailing into the wind and really playing things as close to the line as they can. And as brand professionals, I'm sure you will agree, it is a delight working with innovators in all the spaces we're active, and seeing how they work and just how excellent they are at knowing where they can navigate and where they can't. The examples you gave of parties like Paddy Power and whatnot, it is quite amazing. And all the discounters that obviously so frequently come up in these conversations. It is fantastic to see how well they can navigate the landscape. I think my overarching thought is, what happens if we do not legislate to prevent the ambush marketers? What happens if we take a free market approach and we just stand back and say, you know, if you want to offer an affiliate or a sponsorship type program with a massive event, it's on your head, do it, manage it as well as you possibly can, bearing in mind that there are going to be parties who either have not been able to get access to the legitimate modes of publicity, you know, or who've decided their own methods of publicity through your event are more lucrative than the official route, and you know, deal with it as they come. And my thinking here is that, provided consumers are not confused, the presumed result is that the event will become less valuable and less lucrative as a it'll lessen an appeal to third parties who want to go through it. But I think that, thankfully, the events will continue developing new ways of addressing the ambush marketers, which the ambush marketers will then continue finding new ways of getting around. And I think that in order for there to be an event which is sufficiently lucrative that there are third parties becoming affiliates and sponsors, in order for that to continue happening, they will have to continue monitoring themselves and keeping the ambush marketers out to keep it sufficiently valuable for there to be interest. So I think the model is self-sustaining, and it will keep going. And I think, as I said, provided there is no confusion, personally, I look forward to seeing how the ambushers will continue to walk this fascinating line, and how they will continue to be challenged by the legitimate parties.
Thank you, Cameron. It sounds like you think the balance is about right, and in the meantime, we can enjoy the kind of cat and mouse game and the creativity that inevitably entails. I'm afraid that is all we have time for today, but thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you've enjoyed the discussion around this fascinating topic.